Welcome to Assembly Line, the podcast for entrepreneurs building on the Salesforce platform. We'll go behind the scenes with innovative founders and leaders to share their stories, strategies, and lessons to accelerate your own path to success as a Salesforce ISV. Are you struggling to make sense of the Salesforce security review? It's the number one roadblock slowing down your AppExchange launch. Security Review Partner translates those complex reports into a simple, prioritized checklist. Stop deciphering jargon and start shipping faster. Get the clear, step-by-step guidance you need to pass the review with confidence. Simplify your path to market. Visit securityreviewpartner.com today. That's securityreviewpartner.com. So I'm joined today by Jordan Fleming of Smartphone, serial entrepreneur, multiple podcast host, and all-around great guy. Looking forward to the conversation. Welcome, Jordan.
Absolutely, Scott. Thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to a good conversation today.
Yeah, me too. All right, so tell our listeners a little bit about Smartphone. I know you're the founder and now chairman of the company. So maybe you give some background on the company and the applications, you know, what it does, who it's for, and what problems it solves specifically.
Absolutely. So Smartphone is an all-in-one cloud phone system. That means all of your calls, text, phone numbers, video calls, power dialing, you know, basically all of the telecom suite in one platform. And really our biggest kind of focus from the very beginning is to use the cloud phone system platform to empower a good CRM. Amazing opportunities that you have when you fully integrate your phone system, your communication streams into your CRM. I mean, it's incomparable, and that has been our focus. And we started out we're bootstrapped, 100% bootstrap software product. We started out in 2017. We now got about 60 people. Got about 2,500 active logos using our platform on a daily basis to make millions of calls and send millions of texts. And really, you know, as we started out and we started to just pick off the CRMs we wanted to connect with. So we don't have a light touch Zapier model of connection. When we integrate with a system like Salesforce, we choose to fully integrate it so that it's a seamless experience and so that your CRM gets the most power behind it. That's really where we focus.
Very cool. Yeah, I mean, so you said you founded the company back in 2017. I think a lot of listeners that have experience on Salesforce platform we'll recall building telephony integrations with dialers, and so it's not by any means a new model, and yet it just seems even with all the automation, all the advances in AI, I know that still just good old telephone is a very core piece of so many businesses. So it makes sense to kind of tap into that. How, you know, what were you working on before, I guess, in 2016 leading up to Smartphone that kind of led to the idea for the application?
Yeah. So Smartphone exists because at the time, I had a consultancy, another business, and we were building custom. We were essentially an SI, but for a different platform.
Okay.
Not Salesforce. And it's a platform called Podio. I'll throw it out there. And we were essentially, I had built a team that was designing custom CRMs for people. And we stumbled into a couple verticals and we were gaining momentum. And at that time, two things happened. One, we were tasked, we had an internal project to connect a phone system into to Podio. And there was no good options. Like there were options, but they were all webhook based, and they all, you know, and there's no seamless capability there. That happened. At the same time, I met my co-founders. I met my co-founders because of an event around this other system, and you know, we sort of hit it off. They had a very technical team when I had the sort of sales and marketing expertise, and they said, well, we should do something together. And I said, well, you know, I got this idea for a phone system. And genuinely what happened was we, you know, my, one of my partners, Vlad at the time, he's the CEO now, he took over from me as CEO. He was the CTO for years. He said, I can build that. And we built it, and we were the first to integrate with that platform. And that gave us at first to market bit, which let us scale very rapidly with zero investment. And then as we scaled, and we reinforced our dominance in that market, we started to vertically look at other CRMs where there is a strong vertical presence we had an in on, and where we could build a deep integration because we understood the vertical. And that has been how we've scaled up. But it came because I was building custom systems and saw the opportunity that, man, these systems would be so much better if we had a fully integrated phone system.
Nice. I think consulting can be a great route to picking up on patterns that that every business is facing, and ultimately leading to like a SaaS product like smartphone that can see a lot of success. Obviously, you mentioned that y'all went the bootstrapping route. I'm curious if that was a conscious choice, or in the early days you just felt like you needed to focus on building and couldn't focus on a pitch deck. And then eventually you just saw so much success, you realized you didn't need it. Or, you know, if you could go back, were there any lessons you learned, or do you think you could have gone faster if you had fundraised, for instance?
I mean, theoretically, but I'd have been miserable. I spent a lot of time around VCs and companies that got VCs in. And my co-founders and I have always had a very, very clear vision that we want nothing to do with it. I don't need someone who doesn't care about our product or our team breathing down our neck to hit arbitrary targets, to hit whatever financial goals they have. They don't really care about the product, the business, the people. We never considered taking investment. We always, you know, had to build it ourselves and, you know, and try and make it work. We both had other companies. So this was, I don't want to say a side project, but it was like, it's not like we quit our jobs and, you know, and put our life savings in. Yeah, we invested all our time and effort and money into it, but we were doing that while still making money, making a business work. And we did that very purposely because, yes, you theoretically can maybe gain more speed, but I don't think I don't think that trade-off is worth it. You know, would I rather have a $15 to $20 million company where we all still own the whole thing and we're having a great time? Or would I rather have a $40 million company where my shareholdings reduced to 6% and they're preferential and I'm not, and I've got, you know, all that? It was never a question. And if I had to go back again, I'd do it again exactly the same way.
That's great. I think that's a choice that a lot of founders face early on. And I think you hit the nail on the head of, you know, the downsides that come with that money: stress, loss of control. So that's great. And it sounds like, honestly, you also saw a lot of success. I mean, you're an 8-figure ARR company, I believe. Sounds like bootstrapping didn't really hold you all back at all.
No, I mean, we were historically growing. We were growing at least 60% year on year. Now, for a VC company, that wouldn't be good enough, right? But for anybody else, what are you talking about? If you were going to give any other business a, hey man, do you think you'd like to grow 60% year on year for 7 years in a row? They'd be like, yeah, right? And it's only the weird VC math that makes that not as good enough. And, we grew solidly, consistently, very steadily, predictably. And I would take that all over again. And I can't imagine, you know, it's only a VC company that would say that's not good enough.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you had the consulting background. You saw in a lot of your projects the need for integration with a tool like smartphone, and Podio didn't have it at the time. Was that enough validation for you that there was a need for smartphone in the marketplace, or did you do anything else to kind of validate product market fit before building? Okay.
Absolutely nothing. Genuinely, absolutely nothing. I'd love to pretend like I did. I made everything as a carefully calculated and researched bet. Nonsense. I had an idea. I've always been good at spotting opportunities and seeing, you know, seeing the gap. I saw an opportunity. I went for it with my co-founders. We went for it. We went for the ride. No guarantee it would work. I mean, I remember when we launched, you know, I would say we were profitable very quickly. It's sort of, when you launch something like this, traction's the hardest thing.
Right.
Traction's the hardest thing. And if you can manage to get that bit of traction going with a software business, your game changes very quickly. I see the biggest mistake that I see most software companies making is that they assume that traction's the easy bit, building it's the hard bit. And
yes,
right. And like building it is easy. It's getting easier by the minute. Building it is easy. Getting genuine traction where you have momentum of growth and where which we were able to scale to well past a couple $1 million in annual revenue just off that initial platform. With zero outbound sales, 100% inbound, no sales team, all product led. And I think that traction was a combination of luck, 100% luck, and just the exact right time. We had the right product for the right vertical in the right system. Like we had everything hit exactly right. And I'd love to pretend like that was calculated. It wasn't.
It's refreshing to hear your honesty that, you didn't go off and do 100 interviews, and
didn't do one
50 with potential customers. But yeah, I actually heard a quote recently that I really liked, you mentioned you had a knack for spotting opportunity. I heard this quote that, something only looks like an opportunity in hindsight, and at present it always just looks like a risk. So it's very nice to be able to filter through.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly the opposite way.
Oh, okay, all right.
I look at exactly the opposite. I see, and maybe that just says something about my risk. I've always been a risk taker. I mean, I've always been a risk taker in every part of my life. Like that's my. If I had to choose between looking and leaping, I will leap 100% of the time and just trust that I'm going to figure something out, you know? I think that I very rarely see risk. I see opportunity.
Okay.
And the risk's just part of the game, part of the life. But it's like, to me, and I think that worry on risk holds people back a lot. And if the shot's there, take the shot. If you hesitate at all, the shot may have moved on. And so I would flip that in my view of, you know, I see opportunity first and risk I look at as, oh, in hindsight, oh, that was a bit risky. I don't worry about that till the end.
Well, now you've flipped my whole thought process on this. I like the optimistic outlook on that. That's great. Has that ever come back to? Has that ever caused challenges?
Yeah.
In the early days of smartphone, when you leapt without looking.
In smartphone, no.
Okay.
No, not in smartphone. We had a very blessed sort of smooth ride for the first, you know, like it's harder now. It's been a weird market. It's been a weird, like lots of things have been weird, and scale brings challenges, as we all know. Starting a business is easy in the world. Scaling one, harder. But no, with smartphone, no. But I mean, in other areas, sure. Absolutely. But the pain is never, the pain is never bad enough to stop the next risk, you know, like to worry about it again. Whatever it is, it's like, I guess I'm inbuilt to take risks. If I see something, I'm inbuilt to just go for it and not really worry about anything else. And 80% of the time that works out great in my favor. 20% of the time it hurts a little more.
Well, so let's talk a little bit more about early days smartphone. So you saw some early traction. Do you recall any specific tactics or strategies you had for getting your early, like say first 10 customers or so? Were they just kind of gimme from consulting projects?
Kind of. There was a combo. The interesting thing about Podio at the time, the system, was there was a heavy community base to that. Like there was a real community feeling. We had inbuilt message board type things, and I had built a profile in that community that was far probably greater than was valid in many ways, but I had built a profile there, but we also, it gave us a direct line to our customer base that you can't really buy, right? Without the need to advertise, without the need to do any sort of anything. We didn't advertise for the first year,
I don't think. Wow.
Because we had this captive market. We had them there. It was just, you know, and we sort of, once we were able to develop, because we were very, we became vertically focused and we had attraction within a vertical within that community pushed us forward and we responded and we built and we listened and we built the product. We did a lot of that. The biggest thing was listening. You know, we would be getting these customers in because they spotted the same problem that I had spotted, which is, man, we live on the phone sales and we really want to make this a better way of getting our CRM and our lead tracking to work properly. And I think that what we did do really well at the beginning wasn't advertising or channel marketing, anything like that. It was listening to customers and building to their needs and getting into this loop. I was personally involved. Like I am in many ways the face of the company, and I still speak to customers all the time. I still speak to customers. I go to events and meet customers. And what we did really well, successfully, our team, my co-founders, myself, is we engaged with the customer group. We listened to them. We built functionality based exactly what they said, what they wanted. And that just made that traction in the vertical get better and better and better. Because it was like, oh man, we'd love to be able to do this. Boom. You got it. And that really allowed us to, that tightened the traction. It accelerated the traction. And I think, and it allowed us to, or it assisted us in scaling up and being able to scale to a genuinely decent sized company with very little outbound activity. Patel, we're only now doing outbound.
Listening to customers, it sounds so simple, but it's actually not that common, I think.
Listen to customers.
Did you ever have any issues when you had kind of a small sample set of customers to work from, where you know you get feedback or ideas that maybe you were worried this could work well for you, but this is more like a bespoke customization rather than something that would should probably be built into the product? Did that ever turn into it?
Absolutely. When we started, because when you start, you're throwing everything at the wall to see, you know, I mean, there's no avenue when you start that you're not sort of open to. And I remember, God, think back. I remember year one to two, we had this sort of idea of customized development, where if one of our customers wanted something, we'd say, all right, well, that's going to take us 6 hours to do. So that'll be $1,000, whatever, you know, whatever. We killed that relatively quickly. Now we still listen to customers, but it is with a view to, oh, is this such a niche thing that it's just for you? In which case, unless you're real big and you spend a lot of money with us, probably not going to happen.
Right.
But we do listen still, and we go, oh, that's really interesting. That will apply. Yeah, we'll build that because we'll be able to launch it to everybody. But the road, if you've got a SaaS business and you entertain custom development, you're insane. In my opinion, if you're a genuine SaaS where people go to your website, click sign up, put their credit card details, and start using your product, if you consider custom stuff, you're nuts.
It's very hard to be both consultant and SaaS operator. I think it's probably better to lean on partners if anything to customize. That's what Salesforce, for the most part, does. They technically do have an in-house professional services team, but sort of to your point, I think they reserve them for very, very, very large customers.
Yeah, and that makes sense. Like if I don't know, if Netflix uses, I don't know if they use Salesforce, but if Netflix is got a company account for Salesforce and they want to do something, all right.
Right.
Fair enough. You know, you're spending millions of dollars a year. Okay. But for most SaaS companies where, you know, you're particularly, you know, for most SaaS companies that may be working in the SMB mid-market sized people, there's just it's not a cost-effective method of business anymore. And the honest truth is that the SaaS business model is a way, way more scalable and pleasurable business model than knocking yourself out trying to be a consultant where you're bound by hours in the day.
Right. There's always that ceiling over you. But I think it's still tough though for early day founders, because getting that engine humming for a SaaS product takes a little bit longer to get going. And then you see the tempting fruit of just some revenue from some quick consulting gigs, right?
And we did it too. Like, don't give me wrong. Like I said, in years, up until year two, I think, roughly, we were offering a custom service, but it was such a bad idea. But to your point, like, it was such a bad idea. It was badly executed and badly everything about it. Everything about it was terrible. But to your point, the reason that we were doing that was you're still trying to make sure that traction, you know, accelerates and that your growth hits where you want it to go. And in any method and any path that takes you there, you're probably at the start you're going to look at. Mm-hmm. And you can't be blamed for it either.
Sure,
but kill it pretty quick.
All right, so you're seeing a lot of traction, success on the Podio platform, specifically. Obviously, smartphone grew beyond just Podio, and you built out a Salesforce integration. When did that come about? How did you know it was time to move beyond your initial focus of Podio?
That was a really interesting one. It was a real dilemma, because focus is a really important part of building a business and scaling a business. And you can find that focus drifts very quickly. And when focus drifts, that's when the usually hits the fan, because you know, you take your eye off this ball and you try and on the S-bin, this ball and this ball, and then suddenly you realize all the balls are dropped and you're like, oops, what happened here? Well, that's because you were trying to, you'd lost focus. But so we'd reached probably the, a couple million dollars a year in revenue. So strong enough, you know, you're no longer just, will this work? You've got product market fit, you got traction, you're scaling. We're scaling 70%, 6% a year, whatever it was. We knew that we had something. And at the same time, we met a woman called Stephanie Betters, who is, she is the CEO of a OEM CRM built on Salesforce called LeftMain REI.
Okay.
And we were very big in the real estate investment vertical. That was what brought us. That was the vertical, the first vertical that we really hit on where we dominated in Podio. And we are still a very known quantity. We're still a player in that space. We are a player. And we met Stephanie and for various events and real estate and kind of that sort of thing. Met Stephanie and she was using, I'm not going to drop names because I'm not going to slag anyone off. But she was using another provider inside of Salesforce for a lot of what we did. But she didn't really like it. So I won't name any names. Because they're fine. But we got to know each other and we knew the vertical. And so we hit it off. Steph and I really like Stephanie. We're good friends now. And she was like, hey man, like let's do that. Like, let's connect and we'll get you into Salesforce. And because I got customer base that is begging for a better alternative here. And I think you guys are great. And I know we can work together. And we were like, yeah, absolutely. And she brought us, we were brought into Salesforce as our second system CRM that we were connected with. We wouldn't have done it on our own necessarily. I don't know if I'd have bit into the Salesforce apple quite yet, but we were handed Salesforce with 100 customers.
So you, oh, wow. Right? So, that's nice. So right? No, so Stephanie's so company.
It took the edge off.
Right, right.
Right. Stephanie had, and Stephanie is a brilliant Salesforce operator. She knows it. She knows the people. She's great in the ecosystem. She's brilliant at building her business. She's built an amazing business. And we work closely together and we scale together as well because, you know, as she scales, we scale, we bring people to her, she brings people to us. We work very closely together. And she basically brought us in and we built our first unmanaged package specifically to work with her system. And what we, once we reached 150 logos using our unmanaged package, we were like, maybe it's time for us to look at this seriously, right? Like you know, and we were essentially handed those 150 people.
I think probably a lot of listeners are more familiar with the ISV partnership route with building a Salesforce application, but what you just mentioned, so getting connected with Stephanie, you mentioned she was an OEM partner. That can be a great opportunity for finding early traction, I think, for an ISV, because OEMs, at the end of the day, they're a managed package also built directly on top of the same Salesforce platform. And now from a marketing positioning standpoint, they're pushing their own independent CRM, but with the same power and technical
powered by Salesforce, baby.
Exactly. And so building a package, whether it's unmanaged, managed, for an OEM is really no different than just building it for the platform itself. Unless, of course, you built in dependencies on what
she built. But we built certain things to work with her exactly, and then of course when we escalated and built our own managed pack, when we went through that whole process of the security review and building our, you know, so that we're on the App Exchange and all of that, we went through that process after a year and a half of building traction, because it was like, you know, I, again, it was like, okay, well, this is a thing, man. And now let's go after like, let's build this channel. Let's build this pie up a little. And so we built our managed package. But I agree with you that the OEM route is a really interesting one to start your traction game, because every OEM I've ever seen is, well, I shouldn't say every, but most of them, I think, are vertically focused. Mm-hmm. So that's the whole point. That's the whole game. That's why you build an OEM CRM on Salesforce, is that you've got a niche customer base that you're going after. And the vertical focus like that, if you're an ISV that understands those vertical markets, you've got a really, really compelling method, you know, way of collaborating, revenue sharing, and attacking the Salesforce elephant bite by bite.
Building an AppExchange business can be isolating. Are you tired of guessing what the right next move is to grow and scale? Don't go it alone. ISV Forge surrounds you with a curated group of fellow ISV founders who are on the same journey. We combine peer accountability with expert-led weekly webinars to help you overcome roadblocks and build a thriving business. Stop guessing and start scaling. Apply for the next cohort today at isvforge.com. That's isvforge.com. That and yeah, I think if anything, when we're talking about, when ISVs are thinking about partners, they're considering reaching out to SIs, right, that have a lot of consulting projects, and they could say, look, use our app, it will make your project a slam dunk. But this OEM route, I haven't heard of it before, but it's genius. You're right. You immediately start out with focus on a vertical. You have a lot of prospects from day one. And then if someone goes the route that Smartphone did, where you eventually do grow into a standalone managed package on the AppExchange, on day one, you all had over 100 case studies to reflect on and showcase, right?
Yeah, we had paying customers. We had paying customers that, you know, it wasn't like, you know, because going back to the traction issue, traction's hard, man. Traction is hard. And when in our case, it was made inside of Salesforce, it was made so much easier because we were starting out of the gate with an OEM partner who was recommending us and saying, hey, man, you got to use these guys. They're brilliant. And so we were able to learn and grow inside of the Salesforce ecosystem, and we learned and we made mistakes, and then we went, oh, it'll be better if we do it like this and all that. But we did it with an expert by our side, and we did it with 150 customers that are paying us every month.
Mm-hmm. That's nice.
which that's grown, of course, since then. But we started out the gate by having a partnership that was able to help us get going.
Once you did go through the security review process and you published to the AppExchange, how did you? Or did you have any tactics or strategies for kind of optimizing your listing for lead gen, or was it you flipped the lights on and they just started flooding because you had all these
flooding
cases?
I mean, we were still getting, the OEM partnership is still driving stuff to us, of course. I would say that the OEM partner was the best element of that. The AppExchange, the whole process, I would say, has not been hugely fun for us, and it's been challenging, it's the security review setup is a nightmare. Like, Salesforce does some things brilliantly and other things really, really badly.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so Smartphone, you obviously have a managed package, but you also have a third-party platform, right? And external servers, I assume, that made that security
process
a little bit...
Yeah, we're not Salesforce native only.
Right. So that, and that just adds another layer, right, to the security review process. And suddenly they want to look at the servers that Salesforce is communicating with, and that's a whole other ball game too.
Yeah, no, it wasn't a lot of fun. But in general, I would say the review process inside of Salesforce across all products has not been brilliantly managed. It's cumbersome. It's clunky. Whether it's Agentforce and the rollout of Agentforce, which has been, I mean, they've not done a good job. They've got all sorts of opportunity, I think, but they've done a bad job at rolling this out. They've done a bad job for ISVs with the uncertainty on pricing, with the limited capabilities. They launched it like a year and a half too early, it feels. But then they said, hey, everybody's got to do this. And it's not been a great experience from an ISV point of view, I don't.
As an ISV, have you all been building any apps or extension packages for the new Agent Exchange? I know they've been pushing partners to do that.
Tried to, but unfortunately, some of the capability, we've got a brilliant use case for an agent that we're desperate to launch, but the capabilities of Agentforce right now are still locked on in the end, and it's not allowing us to do some of the basic things that we want to do.
There's
a lot of limitations. Agentforce has got a huge amount of limitations right now.
So I'm assuming right now, since y'all already have obviously a lot of experience building, standalone SaaS web app, y'all are probably leveraging AI directly, integrations directly on your platform rather than. And the Agentforce route is specifically for Salesforce customers that want to keep it under that kind of trust umbrella of the Salesforce ecosystem.
Yeah, and to leverage, because again, our big focus has always been empower your CRM, right? Because we really do focus a lot of our messaging and a lot of our features and a lot of our a lot of what we do on this idea of being, your CRM phone system. Because that's where the power is. Your CRM should be a very strong system of record, right? It should be a very strong repository of leads, activities, everything. And so we focused on making the CRMs the best they can be by integrating. And that's where the Agentforce concept is great. We've got a great concept for an agent to allow your CRM inside of Salesforce to thrive even more and your agents to thrive even more. It's just unfortunately that a lot of things right now are being locked off right now due to limitations of Agentforce.
I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about another piece of the puzzle I think a lot of founders have difficulty with, and that's pricing. So you were introduced to, obviously you had a lot of experience building up the business on the Podio platform. Then when you moved over to Salesforce through Stephanie's OEM company, I imagine she was you were able to kind of gauge pricing level sort of probably based on the cost of Stephanie's platform. You're seen as like an add-on. I'm guessing that was kind of a guide. Did you have any instances where you had to reevaluate your pricing from the early days, or have you kind of kept? Did you hit the mark basically when you first launched?
No, so we have two pricing models, and the second model is a Salesforce driven model, and it's not one that's actually very promoted right now. We only do it on actual sales calls. The Salesforce has definitely driven us to bring in a new tier, a new method of pricing, a new concept for pricing. Now, that doesn't mean that we've phased out our existing one, absolutely not. It's just that the Salesforce ecosystem, particularly, there are a lot of SMB to mid-market customers out there that are in our hunting ground. We're never going to be going after more than about, if your company's got more than 400 people, we're not the right fit for you. We're not an enterprise game. That's not who we are. If you're looking for that, then you're going to go with Vonage or someone like that. That's, and you should, quite honestly, I would tell you that if you come to me tomorrow with a 1,000-person company, I'd tell you to go to Vonage. But what Smartphone did decide to do, based on working inside a Salesforce and understanding the customer base more, is to bring in a new method of pricing. So our original pricing method, which is still valid, the pricing has changed a little, but it's still the same model, is you pay for access to the ecosystem of Smartphone, and then you pay for your usage. Right? It's a usage-based pricing. And that's been what we started with. The idea being that instead of arbitrarily paying for people, you pay for usage. That works great. But we have also launched recently a per-user pricing with included usage, mainly because most of the customers, companies we speak to inside the Salesforce ecosystem, they're looking to lock off an understanding of what they're paying for. Right, they're not looking to nickel and dime and be like, you know, they're looking to, it's not about nickel and dime, they're looking for a consistency of what their pricing is going to be. And in the usage model, you can't have that, because in the usage model, so and so may go on a heavy sales drive and suddenly your usage triples and your bill triples. Whereas with the per user pricing, which we just recently launched, we built usage into that per user pricing, but we've kept it as pooled as well, so that if you pay for a seat, a license for, you know, Jim in accounting, and Jim only makes two calls a month, the rest of his minutes that are included go to other people, so that you're not losing that. We've kept that. Yeah, we've kept that because it's always been a core part of who we are and what we believe in, and you know that you should benefit from what you should pay for what you use and not arbitrarily for what you don't. So that's been a really big part of it.
Well, it makes sense that customers want to be able to budget, right, and just know exactly what they're going to spend each month. But specifically, and I think you were kind of alluding to this, Salesforce likes per user pricing in general, right? That's what their model has been for a very long time.
It's what the AEs want to sell off. It helps their PNR. It's what the it's what the market understands.
Right, and it's interesting though, because now with Agentforce, for what I believe is the first time in the company's history, they are
usage
being forced to go with some usage based.
But they're doing
pricing.
It badly. But they're doing it badly. Like, you know, like Salesforce had the opportunity. I will die on this hill. Salesforce had the opportunity to lead this charge, because AI pricing has become commoditized. Let's be honest. If you look at the pricing now for transcriptions and for this and that, that price over the last year and a half, 2 years, has plummeted. It's plummeted, and it has become a commodity. It has become a commodity. And what Salesforce has done with the rollout of Agentforce, with this whole credit thing and like the crazy credit thing, is instead of doing what they should have done, in my view, which is make it so attractive that everyone uses it immediately and capture that market, instead, they rolled out a confusing mishmash of pricing that they continually have to change. They've made it completely weird for the ISVs and completely weird for any company trying to engage with it.
I actually thought Google's approach with Gemini pricing was pretty ingenious. I think they were facing some similar early day challenges of selling the add-on licensing for Gemini. I use Google Workspace at our business. And I just got a notification one day, hey, guess what? You now have Gemini for free as part of your Google Workspace. P.S., we're raising the price of Google Workspace. And I thought, I was like, okay, touche, Google. That was actually pretty smart. Yeah, if people aren't buying it, give it to them and then charge more for what they are buying.
Well, and it is like, if you look at anywhere around the world right now and the different systems that are using AI, the pricing is dropping, has dropped through the floor.
And I think a lot of companies are worried about explosive cost internally, and that is bleeding into their pricing strategy. And to your point, I think maybe ultimately doing a disservice. I Brett Taylor, former exec at Salesforce, was on a podcast and basically was saying this explicitly, that we shouldn't have pricing models that are so tied to the usage of AI, especially since over time everyone's going to be using it. It's going to be built into every product. I think he made a reference that, it's almost as silly as trying to bake in the cost of the computers that were used to build the app. Like, it's going to be so foundational that it's, and to your point, commoditized, that it's long-term. You need to be focused on the value that your features are bringing and charging for that. And I don't have enough data to know if this is actually the case, but I would imagine that companies, you're a great person to ask this, Jordan, since you have AI features built into smartphone. I would guess that the majority of businesses with AI features follow kind of the Pareto principle, where 80% of their AI consumption is probably coming from 20% of the users. And it's not just that you're seeing a lot of usage in a smaller base. It might be easier to control those costs than folks realize or guess or forecast.
I think the challenge is, though, that AI, to your point, AI tools, and they're becoming permission to play, not extra. They've moved very quickly from being specialized to permission to play. Mm-hmm. And if you're not using AI tools in some fashion in your business, I don't understand at this point how. I think, but the problem is that they are, and that goes to your kind of baked in point. They are, in the same way as you assume a platform you buy, a software, a SaaS system you invest in and you sign up to, you assume basic things. You assume it's going to be secure. Mm-hmm. You assume the basic kind of permission to play bits of what a SaaS system is. I think AI's reached that point. If it hasn't reached it yet, it's on the cusp. And that's a problem for pricing where it's usage based. Because that would be like you saying, yeah, if you want to secure your files, every file is going to cost you 1 cent. Mm-hmm. What? To secure my file? I can upload my file for free, but to secure it's 1 cent? Makes no sense to me. I think AI is moving to that point, to the point where it's like, yeah, but I just expect to have this here.
Right.
But that's also where the pricing model is going to have to be. I mean, I think smartphones well positioned for this because we've always had a usage based pricing. Mm-hmm. So it's very familiar to our audience. But we've now brought in this per user pricing where, guess what? There's an unlimited AI add on. Like, don't think about it. There you go. Click the add on. And don't think about it. And don't worry about minutes or whatever. It doesn't matter how much you use. You're gonna be able to use it. So we've got both models.
So that's kind of the AI features that are built in core to the platform. I know you said you've tried to build out an agent exchange app and are facing difficulties, but is the plan then to make that a free add-on, similar to how your core platform is?
The plan, I think that's partly because I think that the model doesn't really, nobody really understands how to sell Agentforce yet. I don't think either. But the truth is this, it's not revolutionary what most agents can do. And what you want is to have it maximize your ISV product. It's like, we've got this awesome tool that you can install for, and it costs us really not. I mean, okay, it costs a bit to develop, it costs a bit to, but there's no real costs to it. They pay Salesforce directly for all of those bits. I think that you know, for a good, a large, maybe an 80-20 principle wise, of agent opportunities, they are enhancers for your product. They are not revolutionary. They will just make it a little better. They'll make it better. They'll make it do something a bit better, but they're not revolutionary.
Yeah. Well, all right. I want to shift gears again, because so I know you were at the helm, CEO of Smartphone, for just shy of 8 years. And then earlier this year, you stepped back as chairman. And I think you said your CTO, your original partner, is now the CEO. So how has your day-to-day changed since stepping back to be chairman? And what has that process been like? Because I think you're light years ahead of where a lot of listeners probably are in their journey, but it's still valuable to hear kind of what things are like at the other end of the rainbow.
Great. It's great. Heck, I don't do anything. No, that's not true. No, look, I mean, it's been great. I think that, you know, I when we founded the company, I was this CEO that grew it to, you know, just under 10 million in annual revenue. And that was hard. And, you know, growing the team to 60 plus some odd people and across a couple countries and doing all that. And one of the things, you know, I'm not a developer, no technical. I'm probably not even a natural CEO. I didn't go to business school. I don't do any of that. I find my way forward. But my skill set is on building partnerships and spotting opportunities and ideas. That's where my real skill set is. And one of the things that we realized over the last year is that as CEO of a scaling business, I was spending way too much time internally focused. You know, not working. Like people say, you know, working in the business or on the business. That's true when you're starting. Once you get to our stage, I wasn't like, what as CEO was I executing on a daily basis? Nothing, really. I mean, it wasn't my job to do that. But what I was doing was I had these teams and departments of people, and I was positioning them and making, you know, I was keeping them where I needed them to be. I was looking, you know, but I was spending a lot of time like this, and it was losing our, you know, my natural ability to look outward, to look at opportunities, to spot partnerships, to develop that. And so when, as a board, we had this discussion earlier this year of changing, you know, of doing an overhaul of the company to get to the next phase of growth. And one of the things that is required for the next phase of growth is for me to be out there building the opportunities. Like I got us to 10. Now, how do I get us to 20? And so in, you know, that's why that was where that was driven from. On a personal level, it was weird to begin with. I'm not gonna pretend it wasn't. I spent 8 years being CEO and being the person who made most of the decisions. But actually it's been wonderful. You know, I have zero day-to-day administrative and executive responsibilities. And my job is to look at look up and do things like that. So it's been fantastic. And I've always only worked 5 hours a day, even when I was CEO.
Wow. But they were very, very productive 5 hours.
Yes. Yeah, I'm very, very productive. But I've never been someone, my mornings have always been for me. I go to the gym, I do walk the dogs, do the gym, do thing, go to my workshop, whatever. And then I tend to work from about 12 till 5.
That's really refreshing, especially right now. I think there's a lot of focus on, you know, hustle culture and sleep when you're dead. And how about just be dead when you're dead?
I've never understood that. And one of the things I'm grateful that my co-founders and I have always shared the same vision on is that you shouldn't, if you're going to be someone who starts a business and lives your life as the I'll be happy when, you know, where you're deferring the enjoyment of your life until this milestone, but then you reach that milestone and well, but what about this milestone or whatever? If you're going to do that, then you are going to find that you are on a treadmill that never stops and that you're not actually enjoying much at all. And we've always been a very different mindset for that. You know, the owners, we've always paid ourselves well. We've always invested in our health and well-being and our holidays and our fun and our families, because that's the whole point of doing this. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, go get a job. Like, you know, but that's, I think that's really important. I hate the hustle culture. I hate this idea of, dude, if you're not working 20 hours a day, you're not really working. Eh. I beg to differ.
I like that. I think you're the voice of reason.
It's the only sane way to be. I will never understand this whole like tech bro hustle culture, sleep on the floor and be miserable because that's the way. Okay. I that doesn't suit me. It doesn't suit my co-founders out.
I love it. Well, this seems like a good place to start wrapping up. But before we do, I want to ask, for someone who's kind of in their early days of their journey, maybe just getting started building out their product, even if it's not native to Salesforce, but just building out an integration, or if they are building out their managed package, do you have any lessons you'd pass down, or you know, what would you tell your former self when you were stepping into the Salesforce world?
The Salesforce world. I mean, I think that the Salesforce ecosystem is a challenge and an opportunity. And, you know, consistency tends to breed results. So if you are, you know, if you want to build relationships with OEMs and SIs and AEs and SEs and RVPs and all those sort of things, you can do that and they can be successful, but consistency breeds results. And I think a lot of times people flit. They see their eyes are bigger than their stomach and they see the opportunity, but it's the consistency that pays off into actual results. And so, you know, don't narrow your focus. Don't broaden it. Narrow your focus, be consistent, and attack bit by bit by bit and be consistent. That's my advice. Cause too often people, you know, if you're looking at 20 things, you're going to get 15 of them done poorly and 5 of them done mediocre. I tend to try and focus on 3 things. And I think that's true in the Salesforce ecosystem. If you see every shiny bit and you run after them all and you flit around, you're not going to have as much success as if you focus in on where am I trying to get to? What is success going to look for this next, 6 months? And how am I going to consistently apply to get that success done?
I love that. That's great. That's great advice. I think we could all use a little more focus in our day to day. All right. So, just for folks, maybe for some OEMs that are listening that want to build in an integration, where can people go to learn more about Smartphone, or how can they get in touch with you?
Well, obviously, Smartphone's on the App Exchange. smrtphone.io is the website as well. I'm sure you could put it in the notes to the podcast. And I'm easiest to be contacted on LinkedIn. Quite honestly, okay. Jordan Samuel Fleming is my LinkedIn. I'm delighted to talk to anybody. Always delighted to, if there's anybody who wants, if I could provide any sort of feedback or advice, always happy to. But also, you know, from an OEM point of view, if you're listening, we OEMs are, we work really well with them because we're the exact right size to go deep and long with them and to support each other. Whereas the bigger players in our space, who are brilliant, the Dialpads, the Ring Centrals, all them in the world, who are great, but they're never going to care about you. Right. And I think, I'm always delighted to speak to OEMs in particular and SIs where we can partner with them, bring value to them, bring value to us.
That's great. Well, thank you so much. We'll definitely link that up in the show notes. I really appreciate the conversation today, though, Jordan. Thanks for having it with me.
Thanks very much. It was an absolute pleasure to speak with you.
Cheers. Are you looking to connect with the most dedicated founders and builders in the Salesforce ecosystem? The AppAssemblyLine audience is made up of the exact ISV partners and entrepreneurs you're trying to reach. We're opening up a few sponsorship slots to partner with brands that can truly help our listeners succeed. If you're ready to connect with the leaders of the AppExchange, you can learn more at AppAssemblyLine.com/sponsor. That's AppAssemblyLine.com/sponsor.